If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Franklin Delano Roosevelt assumed the presidency of the United States in 1933. Becoming the head of a nation facing immense hardship and disenchantment amid the Great Depression. No president, excepting Abraham Lincoln, had come to office in more challenging circumstances. That's the take of Ewan Morgan, Emeritus Professor of US Studies at UCL. Ewan's the author of a new book on the 32nd president, which explores how Roosevelt's four terms in the White House changed the role from that of a chief clerk to an assertive presence on the world stage. He spoke to Eleanor Evans.
Ewan, thank you so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast today.
Pleasure to be here.
And I hope to start with, as you do in your book, can you give us a sense of FDR? What was his route to the presidency?
Well, FDR came from a very old, established, very wealthy, but not fabulously wealthy family, lived in a very posh estate in near Hyde Park in New York. He was the cousin of Theodore Roosevelt, who became president. And life was very good to FDR. He had homeschool tutors as a child, then went to one of the best public schools in the country, then to Harvard. And his life and career somewhat stalled. The most important part of his life in the early 20th century was his marriage to Eleanor Roosevelt, a distant cousin also related to Teddy Roosevelt in 1905. And FDR initially went into the law. His heart wasn't in it, but he always wanted to emulate his kinsman, Theodore Roosevelt, and rise to become president of the United States. He enters politics in 1910, a very good year for the Democrats. The Republicans are split, and Roosevelt, FDR, as he is increasingly known, wins what was thought to be a safe Republican seat in his local area around Hyde Park for the New York State Assembly. He serves a term and then backs Woodrow Wilson candidacy for the Democratic nomination. Wilson is successful, and lo and behold, FDR is offered the post of Assistant Secretary to the Navy, and he has an incredibly important job in preparing the American Navy for possible involvement in the Great War after it breaks out in 1914, and certainly to strengthen national defences in case of attack. He is so successful in that job and becomes so well known, plus the Roosevelt name, that in 1920 he is brought on as vice presidential running mate to the Democratic nominee, Governor Cox of Ohio. It's a very bad year for the Democrats. The country wants normalcy after the disruptions of the Great War, and the Democrats go down to a catastrophic defeat at the hands of the Republicans. But FDR is considered to have had a good campaign. He's seen as a coming man, and it seems that nothing can stop him from becoming president one day. And then in 1921, he suffers a devastating blow when he contracts polio, usually a disease that affects children, but it was a very severe case in FDR's case. And he loses the use of his legs. From this time on, he will spend his life in a wheelchair. But he doesn't let on how disabled he is. Over a course of several years, he builds up his body through weights and exercises to the point that he can appear to be walking short distances with a cane in one hand and balancing on the hand of a necessarily strong companion on the other. And in that, given that he determined to get back into politics, he never loses his ambition for the presidency. In fact, I would argue that his ambition intensifies because he is so determined to prove that the disability will not limit him. And he comes back into politics in 1928 when Alfred E. Smith becomes the Democratic nominee, and Smith effectively cajoles FDR into running for the governorship of New York in the hope that he will help Smith carry the Empire State. Smith loses. He's the first Catholic Democratic Party candidate, and that does not play well with the party's largely Protestant base. But Roosevelt ekes out a very narrow victory in New York's state by fewer than 25,000 votes. But he is now the governor of the most important state in the Union, the largest state in the Union. And before long, the Great Depression hits, and he becomes one of the governors who takes a lead in devising state solutions to the unemployment problem. So he attracts a great deal of attention nationwide. Of course, none of these solutions work because states simply do not have the resources to deal with the mass unemployment, the unprecedented mass unemployment. But nevertheless, FDR is seen now as the most likely candidate for the Democratic nomination in 1932 when he runs against an incumbent president, Herbert Hoover. And in that election, he inflicts a landslide defeat on Herbert Hoover to become the 32nd president of the United States.
So that's a good sense then of the situation in America when he comes to the presidency. Could you also give us a sense of the role of president itself? What was that at the time that Roosevelt comes to power in 1933?
For much of the 19th century, the president was more a chief clerk than a chief executive. Congress was where the power really lay. If you look at the American Constitution, Article 1 deals with the powers of Congress, and they're very specific and numerous. Article 2 deals with the powers of the presidency, and they're largely vague, other than to declare that the president is commander-in-chief. That's the main responsibility, and it's no surprise that in the 19th century, the handful of strong presidents tended, not always, but tended to be president at time of war. Now, as we get into the 20th century, the president begins to grow in influence, partly because there are now national problems pertaining to social conditions and deprivation of urbanization, industrialization, poverty, and workers' rights. And the president becomes an increasingly important player. And we have two presidents in the early 20th century, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who lay the foundations of what historians would call the modern presidency. There's a regression in the 1920s. We have three Republican presidents who don't match up to the activism of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. They are more active than the 19th century presidents, but they don't build on those foundations. Franklin D. Roosevelt is convinced that the presidency should be the center of American government. And the Great Depression gives him his opportunity. When he comes to power, 25% of the workforce at a very minimum is unemployed. We have no idea how many are working on shortened hours and reduced wages of those who actually keep their jobs. Investment is down an incredible 98%. The farm economy is devastated, and the banks, the banking system is on the verge of meltdown. No president has succeeded in more challenging circumstances to the White House than Abraham Lincoln. And I would say only Abraham Lincoln really had as tough a task as FDR. Lincoln's, of course, was to face Southern secession and civil war. Now, the Congress is desperate for action. Congress is largely a debating body. It's very difficult for the legislature to operate as a coherent unit, fast-moving unit. And in these circumstances, the Democrats, who have a huge majority in Congress, are willing to defer to the leadership of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who has the vision and the will to operate a strong presidency. Now, many historians say that FDR improvised what became known as the New Deal, his reform program of his first two terms in office. I am personally of the view that if you study FDR's campaign speeches in 1932, and if you study some of his writings, he actually published a book in the first week of his presidency called Looking Forward. He'd also written magazine articles during the interregnum between his election and his inauguration. And what the outlines of the New Deal are clear. Yes, Roosevelt will improvise, but he knows ultimately where he wants to go. And the watchword for the Roosevelt New Deal, as it became known, is security. That is the one word that holds the essence of Roosevelt's domestic reforms. And what he meant by security was that he believed that unless ordinary Americans had the economic security of a job, decent housing, reasonable healthcare and decent education, then their personal liberties were being violated. He makes a connection between economic security and personal liberty, which is very important. And although the first stage of the New Deal, the so-called 100 days of 1933, focuses on getting the banks, getting business and getting farmers onto their feet after the collapse of 1929 to 1933. In 1935, when he is in his third year in office, he shifts focus to a more bottom-up approach. And this is the New Deal as a great reform program, where he enacts, or he promotes the enactment of social security legislation, effectively the cornerstone of something America has never had before, a permanent national welfare state. He promotes legislation to grant trade unions collective bargaining rights, which is very, very important in propping up standards of living in among the working class. Although I should say that most Americans never joined a union. The unions were largely the collective bargaining agents of, let's use the term, the upper working class rather than the poor. But it was an incredibly important reform. And there were others controlling the utilities companies. It's quite interesting that now we're in a situation that people are talking about a windfall tax because of high energy costs in the UK and elsewhere. Well, FDR was very concerned that the utility companies in the United States were in effect monopolies that gouged consumers with unfair high charges, and he enacts, promotes legislation to ban what were called holding companies, whereby companies far removed from the actual corporation which was delivering the energy were controlling things and boosting profits unfairly, and FDR puts an end to that. The New Deal puts an end to that. And of course, there are major banking reforms to prop up a system where people's bank deposits were very vulnerable in banks which did not really meet national banking standards.
So you mentioned there a number of ways, a number of the reforms that he's promoting. Now, your book explores a number of ways in which he transformed the presidency. That's the central argument of your book. I wonder if we can pick up on the communication particularly, because he did come about a new way of communicating alongside all of these reforms, didn't he?
Yes, that is critically important to FDR. He realizes that this is a country where the Republicans largely control the press. And we have a press which there are some pretty right-wing demagogues in control of the press, most obviously, but not exclusively, William Randolph Hearst, of course, of Citizen Kane fame. And FDR knows that one of the challenges he will face as president is to get his message out to the country, unfiltered by hostile editorial comment in the newspaper empires of these conservative moguls. He exaggerates the extent of press opposition to him. There were some newspaper publishers, Marshall Field in Chicago, David Stern in Philadelphia, for example, who were very pro-New Deal. But by and large, the big press barons as a group were against him, and they owned a lot of the media. So he develops a multi-pronged strategy to achieve this. The first is that he begins holding regular press conferences. Now, we take presidential press conferences today for granted. In those days, presidential press conferences were, they'd been held by presidents from Theodore Roosevelt onwards, but they were never twice a week as Roosevelt racked them up. And it's certainly in the 1920s, the presidents of the 1920s would not answer press questions unless they had the written questions to hand first. FDR comes in and he says, ask me any question you want. No need to put it down on paper. I will try and answer it. Now, this, of course, is manna from heaven to the reporters. My goodness me, somebody is going to give us copy. And they loved FDR for it. Here was a man who they could rely on, not to parrot stale, hackneyed sentences, but to give them something. FDR, of course, was quite capable of, not answering the question that had been set. He was also capable of being ambiguous. And I have to say, once or twice, he downright lied. But by and large, the press really, really liked him. Compared particularly to his predecessor, Herbert Hoover, this man was the fount of national news. And so that was the first thing. And because they liked him so much, even the reporters who worked for anti-FDR papers would give pro-FDR reports in their copy for the newspaper. They couldn't control the editorials, of course, but they could sort of put a slant on the news articles that came out. So that was the first thing. Secondly, FDR realizes the communication potential of radio. He's not the first radio president. Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge in particular, had used the radio to their benefit, but none used it like FDR. Many of FDR's major speeches were broadcast live on national radio. And, of course, most famously were the so-called fireside chats, which he institutes to share his thoughts with the American people. Now, the fireside chats, there are only, depends how you count it, there are only about 16 during the 1930s. So, that's about 2 to 3 a year. There are more in the war years, but ultimately, depending on how you count it, I counted 31 in total. And he's president for 12 years. Now, work out the math. But it was their infrequency that gave them their punch. And people thought FDR had such a intimate way of delivering his message that people would say, oh, he's come into our homes. And, we know what the President of the United States is thinking. It's almost as if he's our neighbor. And the first one was the most impactful one. In the first one, very, very early in FDR's first term, he's enacted banking legislation to try to save as many banks as possible. The only problem is that people are still taking their money out of banks, and a lot of people are holding their money under the bed, so to speak, because they don't trust the banks. So he goes on radio on the 12th of March 1933. He's only been president for 8 days. And he explains the banking crisis. He explains what needs to be done. And he says, the only way we're going to solve this is if you put your money back in the banks. It's up to you. Now, we've created the framework. And next day, it's fantastic. People are queuing up outside banks to put their money back in. The smaller banks in out-of-the-way places, a lot of them collapsed. They could not be saved. But most of the banks were saved. And at a time when FDR took office, the outgoing Hoover administration assumed that at least one-third of all banks could never be reopened. And to the very small percentage, 10%. Approximately the fate. But that fireside chat really established the pattern of Roosevelt as a great communicator. He's not always as successful, of course, but he uses the fireside chat sparingly to share his thoughts on what needs to be done to combat the Depression during the 1930s and to boost national morale during the war. A third element, which is often forgotten in FDR's communication strategy, the newsreels are coming into their own. There's no television, of course, but The newsreels, the talking newsreels, you know, late 1920s. By 1933, the newsreels are an essential part of any cinema programme. The studios who own a lot of the Hollywood studios that own a lot of the cinemas in the country are desperate to get people back in. They begin showing double bills, and between the main A film and the B film, you have the newsreels. And FDR was the star of the newsreel. He appears in his first 100 days in more newsreel than Herbert Hoover did in his 4 years in office. And the newsreels show FDR moving, taking decisions. Voice is part of the appeal. And FDR helped to make the newsreels a vital source of information for the American people who went to the cinema, and they in turn made him appear heroic.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The only person that holds a candle to him is Abraham Lincoln. Why do I think that FDR was deserving of the number one spot over Abraham Lincoln? Lincoln was never tested in the arena of peace.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Okay. Now, without wanting to skip us too far ahead right away, you've mentioned a couple of times 12 years, four terms. I'm sure a few listeners might be thinking, well, where do those four terms come from? Aren't they only allowed to do two? So what was happening there? What led to that?
Well, in the original Constitution, there was no term limit on the president. George Washington, the first president, effectively established a two-term convention when he retired at the end of his second term. Now, up until FDR, every president had observed that two-term convention. FDR in 1940 breaks that convention. Why does he break it? Well, there are two main reasons. Everyone will say the most important reason is that there's war in Europe. These are dark days indeed for Britain. During the party conventions of 1940, France fell during the Republican convention. And FDR had a sense that continuity and experience were essential. He was wary of the Republicans, who had a strong isolationist wing, non-interventionist wing in their party. And so that was one reason he ran. Often underestimated or overlooked is the fact that he did not think that the New Deal and his legacy would be safe in any hands but his. He hadn't been able to groom a successor, for want of a better term. He tried with several people, but there was always some problem that limited their potential. And so he just as important as the foreign policy concerns are the domestic policy concerns. And he's determined to have a liberal vice presidential candidate in place of the very conservative vice presidential running mate he had in his first two terms. And now he turns to grooming a successor in the person of Henry Wallace, who's been his Secretary of Agriculture for two terms. The party doesn't want Wallace. And Roosevelt sends a message to the Democratic Convention in Chicago that if Wallace isn't accepted, he will withdraw from the race. Now, this is almost purely a domestic politics-driven decision. So what I'm saying is, yes, the war is very significant in FDR's decision, but so were domestic considerations and the preservation of liberalism. But by 1944, FDR is ill. In fact, he is desperately ill. He should never have run. But he decides to serve, to continue serving, because the war is not yet won, and he feels that he alone can negotiate with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill an effective post-war settlement. FDR doesn't know how ill he is, he suspects it, and I think that had he lived longer, he would probably have relinquished the presidency. That, of course, he dies into his weeks into his fourth term. Now, when the war is over, FDR's opponents, domestic opponents, conservative Republicans, and it has to be said, conservative Democrats, are determined there will never be another president of such longevity as FDR. And they approve a constitutional amendment limiting the presidency to two terms to begin after President Harry S. Truman, FDR's successor, has completed his term. Truman could have run in 1952 under the terms, but chose not to. But the important thing is that this had to be ratified by the states, three quarters of the states. Now, state legislatures, certainly in the 1930s and 1940s, they're not at the forefront of progressive thought. Most of them are conservative-dominated, rural over-representation. And what happens is that the 22nd Amendment, limiting the president to two terms, is enacted by three quarters of the states within 3 years, which is remarkably quick. Only two states, Massachusetts and Oklahoma, actually rejected it. Why? I think Americans decided that even though they had wanted FDR in 1940 and 1944, they were nervous about creating a monarchical president, if you like. They wanted a Republican president who would be limited in his time in office, and that was the outcome of it. Paradoxically, of course, of the presidents who followed, had there been a possibility of a third term, Dwight D. Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan almost certainly could have had a third term had they been allowed one, both of them Republicans. So a bit of shooting in the foot there. Or the other person who I guess might have got a third term on the strengths of his economic policies, if not his moral stance, of course, was Bill Clinton.
Okay, so to return then to FDR's sense of the presidency, perhaps you can look at him then in terms of the foreign policy and the sense of America on the world stage. How did he perceive his own role and America's role in global terms?
Well, FDR was an internationalist. He had been a Wilsonian. He had supported Woodrow Wilson's efforts to establish a League of Nations with American membership after the First World War. And he believed that the United States had to play an active role in world affairs because of the rise of the dictators. Hitler actually takes power in Germany 4 weeks before FDR becomes president. And you have a growing number of autocracies who are dissatisfied with the Treaty of Versailles, which was negotiated after the Great War, and want to change it. And, of course, he sees Germany rearming in violation of the Treaty of Versailles clauses. He sees Italy in 1935 invading Abyssinia and trying to build a colonial empire in Africa. And he's worried about Japan, which is looking to expand its the basis of its economic power by taking territory in mainland China and building up its navy in order to become the most significant force in the Pacific. The problem is, for FDR in the 1930s, he's a leader without followers in foreign policy. The American public is heartily sick of international politics. They begin to believe that involvement in the Great War was a mistake. They don't want to have anything to do with the United Nations. And FDR's moderate efforts to push them, one such effort was to get the United States to join the World Court, which was the United Nations legal agency to settle disputes. And even to join this non-military body was too far. In 1935, the Senate rejects his proposal, and he's really beginning to get worried that the United States will be perpetually on the fence. In the second term, things begin to change. In many ways, the dividing line is the failure of what is known as the Ludlow Amendment, proposed as a constitutional amendment by a Democrat, Representative Louis Ludlow of Indiana. And Ludlow's amendment decrees that the United States cannot go to war unless you have a national referendum to approve it. Completely crazy, of course, even if it was done from the best ideals. And that is defeated. And from that point on, FDR becomes becomes bolder. In 1937, he gives a speech in Chicago, the epicenter of isolationism, calling for the quarantining of the aggressors, saying that the democratic nations have to rally together against the aggression of the autocrats. That is something of a lead balloon, but the next year the Munich crisis occurs and there's a shift in opinion. Slowly but steadily, FDR breaks down opposition, but on one point he knows he cannot cross the line. He cannot take the United States into war without it being attacked. Because he knows that that war will not have consensual support at home. And although he's been criticised for not giving Britain sufficient support, not doing more to resist the dictators, it's Roosevelt being the fox rather than the lion, to use the Machiavellian term. He knows the limits. FDR's got a very keen sense of limits in most instances. And what he does is that he continually prods and pushes. His main goal is to repeal the neutrality legislation, which forbids the United States selling weapons to belligerent nations. And of course, this helps the Nazi Germany and Italy, who have been building up their armaments, and hurts those countries that have been late to rearm. So what we have then, we go into 1940, the phony war, And then suddenly the world changes. Hitler's blitzkrieg knocks France out of the war, takes the whole of continental Western Europe. And from that point on, FDR becomes bolder. He gets repeal of the neutrality legislation. American public opinion is swinging to the belief that the United States should do all within its power to defeat Hitler, short of becoming involved in the war. Now, FDR is now playing again the game of the fox. He wants to be safe on third, as he said. He wants to win a third term. And then he would push, because he feared that if he's too forward, he could very well lose re-election. As soon as he's safely re-elected, he pushes through the Lend-Lease legislation, whereby, in his famous phrase, the United States will lease weaponry to Britain to keep it in the war. And then when the British are finished with the legislation, they'll either give it back, or pay for it, which, of course, we never did. And that really keeps Britain fighting in the war in 1941. And then, of course, Hitler invades Russia. And FDR is determined to help the Soviet Union. Now, this is a big deal, okay? The State Department is full of anti-communists who would have actually preferred Hitler to defeat the Soviet Union, because they saw the Soviet Union as ultimately the greatest threat. So Roosevelt has to really crack down on his bureaucracy to make sure that the weaponry is being sent to the Soviet Union. He puts a few trusted lieutenants in charge of lend-lease supplies to the Soviet Union. Tell Stalin, ask for anything you want, we'll give it to you. And in essence, helps to keep the Soviet Union in the war when Hitler had assumed that it would be knocked out in about 2 months. So by the end of 1941, FDR has propped up Britain and the Soviet Union with weaponry, but that's all, and financial support, I should say. The British are saying, look, we can't guarantee convoy safety across the North Atlantic. The Americans effectively arm their merchant marine and put naval escorts to protect them. So the United States is effectively in the war in the North Atlantic, but it's an undeclared war in late 1941. Surprisingly, it isn't in the Atlantic that the spark of war is lit. It's in the Far East, which FDR probably wasn't paying sufficient attention to. It's significant that he delegated his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, to do the main negotiating with the Japanese. The longer the situation in the Pacific goes on, whereby the Americans are squeezing them economically, prohibiting oil exports to Japan, that Japan will progressively weaken. And they decide on this surprise attack on Pearl Harbor as a way to knock out the American Pacific Fleet and to get into the war in order to conquer vast swathes of East Asia.
So clearly then his wartime leadership is very well remembered and obviously was a hugely significant part of his presidency. But if we can return to your your central argument then, you write that he transformed the presidency from, quote, a rather small personalised institution into the driving force of national government. I wonder if we can hear from you then on his broader presidency and the legacy he left for his successors, both consciously and unconsciously.
Okay, well, FDR made the presidency the central focus of American government. In the 100 Days of 1933, he pushes and pushes legislation at Congress, and Congress enacts in FDR's first 3 months in office, 15 major pieces of legislation. Now, this is unprecedented. Congress is a deliberative body, slow moving, but suddenly there's this splurge of New Deal legislation aimed at strengthening the banking system, helping farmers, dealing with unemployment, getting business back on its feet. And what emerges from this is that the president is now acknowledged as chief legislator. Now, the president has got no legislative power. Only Congress can enact. But what Roosevelt has done is established the president as program creator. You know, so the legislation goes to Congress with presidential messages. FDR uses all his political influence to get support for his measures. And Congress is in the situation by the end of the 100 days that it retains its fundamental constitutional powers, of course, but it looks to the president for legislative agenda leadership. So that is one of FDR's great legacies. From this point on, if we think about presidents like Lyndon B. Johnson and the Great Society, Ronald Reagan and the conservative revival, even down to Joe Biden, who's suddenly had this splurge of legislative successes of late. You know, presidents are measured by their legislative leadership now. That's the first thing. The second thing is that FDR lays the foundations of the welfare state in the 1930s and the warfare state in the 1940s. He builds up a huge federal bureaucracy. He can't do all this on his own. I mean, he's one man. There are only so many hours in the day. But he creates a presidency which is more than the president. It's now an executive bureaucracy. In 1939, he finally gets legislation creating the executive office of the president, and the executive reorganization that flows from that makes the presidency not only the initiator of legislation, but also program implementer, program coordinator, and in effect ensuring that legislation as enacted is delivering what the president wants. Very important, the creation of the executive presidency to manage the welfare state and to manage the warfare state.
So to wrap us up then, Ewan, I wonder if I could pose a broad one again. Having written so widely about presidents through history, can you give us a sense, in your view, of is there anyone who comes close to the transformative terms of FDR?
Well, firstly, FDR's transformative significance is not thought of as a good thing by conservatives in the United States. There are frequent presidential polls in the United States of who the greatest president was, and they usually poll historians, pundits, etc. And Abraham Lincoln is by far and away the most common number one. George Washington also edges FDR. FDR, somehow or other, he's controversial. He was the lion and the fox. Was he trustworthy? Did he always tell the truth? Well, in my opinion, he got things done in a way that nobody else could have done. So the answer to your question is, depends who you're asking. Okay, if you're asking me, the only person that holds a candle to him is Abraham Lincoln. Why do I think that FDR was deserving of the number one spot over Abraham Lincoln? Lincoln was never tested in the arena of peace. He's a great war president. He's killed just as the war is coming to an end. Would he have been able to manage the reconstruction of the South in a more skillful way than his successor, Andrew Johnson, did? Well, we'll never know. In FDR's case, he is tested in the arena of economic depression, worst economic depression in American history, greatest foreign war in American history. He's a very active commander-in-chief. He keeps his military generals in line and prevents them from making quite significant strategic miscalculations. Give you an example, his top military men, generals and admirals, wanted an invasion of France in 1943. It was premature. The likelihood of it coming off, very unsure. FDR wants a more circuitous route, and he insists on the generals bowing to his authority as commander-in-chief. So, this is a guy who doesn't just sit around waiting for his generals to tell him, we're going to do that, we're going to do this. He's actively involved in wartime decisions. The big question with FDR, and this is another what-if question, as happens with Lincoln, he dies in the early months of his fourth term. Had he lived, would he have been able to hold together the victorious Grand Alliance of the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States into the peace? Could FDR, who was the linchpin of that alliance, who worked very, very hard to gain Stalin's trust, was going to use not America's atomic monopoly to browbeat Stalin in the after the war, but use the carrot of economic aid. And he also believed that Stalin trusted him. Insofar as Stalin was capable of trusting anyone, he comes close to trusting FDR. Now, had he lived, would there have been a Cold War in the way that we know it? Historians are divided. They say FDR was already beginning to lose trust in Stalin. I don't think that's true. The day before FDR dies, he sends his last cable to Winston Churchill, who's warning about Stalin betraying the Yalta Accords and establishing a single-party communist government in Poland. And FDR tells him, look, we've just got to hold Stalin's trust. We've got to be patient. We've got to ensure that he has no cause to break with us. And if we can hold him, I'm sure that all our difficulties and disagreements will iron out and we'll have a workable peace. Now, whether he could have fulfilled those words, we don't know.
That was Ewan Morgan, FDR, Transforming the Presidency and Renewing America, is published by Bloomsbury and is out now. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.